Hello, this is What the Heck for Richard Dweck, Season 3, Episode 9, with Angelo Gingerelli. Angelo hosts the open mic on Monday at the Brighton Bar in Long Branch. He's one of the originals of the comedy scene in New Jersey of the 2010s, and he's just been great, and I'm really excited to talk to him. He's been, you know, a tremendous key player and help in me getting started and me finding my way through this, you know, this great, scene of comedy landscape. And I can't wait to talk to him. So he has a podcast called My Cousins, Me and My Cousins, and he's known as, on all platforms as Mr. Fifth Round. That's Mr. and then, the number five, fifth, TH, round. And, he's great. It's a big rap head. I want to get into really how ambitious he is, so I have a lot of questions for him. Great. Tune in. This is Season 3, Episode 9, with Angelo Gingerelli.
Hello. Hello.
Hey, man, it's Angelo. How you doing?
Good. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Is it? It's a few minutes late. Is that a big deal? I apologize.
No, it's not. It's not. It's fine.
Cool.
I actually charged my phone up all day. I was like, I got it to 80%, so I'm happy because the past couple episodes I was charging it the whole time. So I was like, this is good. Okay. You are on Season 3, Episode 9 of What the Heck with Richard Dweck. So, you can still hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah,
okay?
I can hear you. So I had a lot of things that I wanted to ask you. I don't know if you've ever been asked this before, but you seem to be very, ambitious to me. Were you ever involved in any type of student government growing up?
No, man, that's actually a pretty good question. I wasn't. When I was a kid, I played sports. And I was super quiet, way quieter than anybody that knows me now could imagine. And looking back, I really wish I was involved. I didn't do any kind of theater, any kind of student government, none of that. And I wish I did because I think it would have helped me be better at what I'm trying to do now.
Right.
But I'm older than you, obviously. I grew up in the 90s. In the 90s, high school and was so, segregated. It was you were one thing and you're only that one thing.
Right.
And it's just me or my friends were not into any of that stuff, so I just didn't do it. I kind of wish I did, and I think I kind of become, I guess, ambitious. I like to do things now. Maybe because I didn't do stuff like that when I was younger, maybe it makes me more driven to do it now.
Right. You just have a lot of hustle. That's just what I That's a word that I would associate with you because you've done so much. You were kind of you mentioned this. I hope I didn't come off the wrong way when I was talking about this earlier on the podcast. I mean it. I don't mean it in a mean way, but when I first saw you, you've really really built yourself up and really done a great job at making this community that we have exist. Actually, how did that come?
Hey, man, I really appreciate that. I'll tell you that once. I just want to get one thing clear because I always made the joke, saw me doing stand up. And then said anybody could do it, right? And that's not – I don't – that's not at all what happened between the two of us. I was there pretty early in your journey. But I've had to explain this to people a couple of times. I'll do it on – this is the first time I'm doing it on a podcast, so you got the exclusive here. Right. I really lean into, the Rodney Dangerfield, get no respect stuff.
Right, yeah.
And realize I realize that's not the I think it's funny. That's the reason I do it.
I know. I know.
Yeah, and I never I don't want to offend anybody because I sometimes if people say I'm on a podcast and I'll bring it to Brett and people I see offended. I'm 99% offended by anything. I have a thick skin. I'm a good sport. I like being roasted. But that so that's kind of what just I don't play inside. I think it's good. Stuff for the I get laughed at or give me for it, but so big, and I was for the first people to do the kind of thing we do in mom and then it's I grew, I liked it more. Like, I just part of it, and I like the people I met. I just do more, open more vent, you know, do more podcast. Just I should call.
Oh, 2013.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious what year it was that you started. I was like, it had to be 2012 or 2013. I was just curious because, like, looking back at it now, like, when I started, like, you know, you were one of the, like, first integral people that was, like, around. And I know there's been, like, you know, just by meeting the other, like, much older comics that have been around, like, how did that sort of, like, come about? Like, were they the first ones, like, when you were first coming around, were they a big part of the scene and you were kind of like the new guy?
I guess the best way to describe it is this, man. In 2007, I was living up in North Jersey, yeah. Right? I didn't know about Jersey's comedy scene, but I was doing open mics in the city.
Oh.
Okay? And it was cool. And I did it for all of 2007, a little bit of 2008. And then in 2008, just a bunch of like personal things happened. Right. Some were good, some were bad. But I had to take a break from comedy. I couldn't get to the city as much as I wanted to. Right. And then in 2012, I got married and moved down the shore to Long Branch. And when I got to Long, we got to Long Branch, started hanging on Asbury right away. And then it was a venue called the Showroom that unfortunately just shut down. Yeah. But that's where I went to a comedy show there. And I ended up talking to the booker and because I, you know, still knew comics, still was interested in it. And she was quitting. That was her last show she was producing. Right. She was moving to the city to take another job. So I emailed the owners and I'm like, hey, I did comedy in the city for a little while. I just moved to the area. I know comics. I could book the show once a month for you. And that was Comedy on Cookman.
Yeah.
And that was the summer of 2013. And it was really the right time, right place kind of thing, right, where it was really successful for 2 years. And then that kind of got my foot in the door in Asbury. And kind of opened the door for it was not the first comedy show. I'm not saying that, but it was one of the first regularly booked. We normally brought, and at the time I was bringing down headliners from North Jersey and New York because those are the people I knew. Right. And then within a year of that, all the local scene was flourishing so much. We were booking that with just, you know, Asbury and Monmouth County people and still filling the theater. And that kind of, and then from there was the open mic at Bank on Madison started. And then the ball really started rolling from there.
Yeah, Comedy on Cookman was, I remember when I first saw that, like, I got into the whole scene in 2015. And I started doing improv in 2011, the summer of 2011. And, like, I always, like, instantly, I said this a bunch from the podcast, but I instantly wanted to do, I thought I was going to do improv for, like, 6 months. And then I ended up doing it for, like, 5 years. And I just sort of got sidetracked. But, like, I look back at it and, like, I wouldn't really change much of anything because I'm not that type of person. Because I sort of believe, like, in a butterfly effect of, like, if you change one thing, everything will change, like, forever. But, like,
sure.
I do regret, like, that I didn't start sooner because, like, Comedy on Cookman, I think, ended, like, a year or, like, at least 6 months before I came into the scene of doing stand-up.
The last Comedy on Cookman was May of 2015.
Okay.
Right.
So,
and then just real quick, what happened, right? My daughter was born in June of 2015. And then my first show back after being a dad was at Crust and Crumble. The first open mic back was at Crust and Crumble in July of 2015. And you were on that show.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember because I met you at met you at that improv show before that.
That was my third time doing stand up, was my first time there. And, I like what happened with doing improv was Mike, he started having comedians on, like, locally. So they would come on and intro and do, like, introduce our show. They'd do a couple minutes. I met Mark there. I met, you know, a couple people that don't do it anymore. And, or maybe they do it in there somewhere else. But, he knew that I'd been wanting to do it forever. So he's like, you know, do you want to try it? And I did it twice and I bombed. And then Dylan Manegan, he was on my improv team. We had like an A team and a B team. I was on the B team. And Dylan was doing stand up too. And I was like, where do I go, man? Like, I've been looking for this for years. Like, where do I go? Like, I had no idea, like, what open mics were or anything. Like, I was so, like, uninformed. So, like, when he told me about the Crust and Crumble, I was like, yeah, I'm there. And then I went there and I met everybody. And it was just like meeting you and meeting just everybody was so cool.
Dude, and that was such a fun time, man. That like 2013 to 2015, because there were so many talented people.
Oh, yeah.
And and everybody was kind of like you were, like just wanting to do this for so long and not having a venue. And then you found this like kind of secret world, and it was almost like you walked in the door and like, oh, I'm home. Now I feel like I'm home.
I would say that, I really wish that I knew these people when I was way younger. And it's just like,
yeah,
it was, I think what was so great about it was we had such a, like that crew of like, I really wish, like, I think they stopped it like a year ago, or maybe it was, it must be a year now.
I think about a year
that,
ago.
That they stopped the Crossing Crumble mic. Like, I wanted to so badly to take it over. I never talked about it with Rob. I should have, because for a while, Jack was pestering him about like taking over, and like I totally wish that I could have, like, you know, maybe talked with Rob or talked with the like restaurant or whatever and see what I could do, because that was my favorite open mic. And
it was fun, man. It was a great time. It was,
I loved it.
Bi-weekly for a while, and then once a month, like you looked forward to it. And I always say, I've told this on multiple podcasts, including mine, so I'll say it again on yours. Yeah. If you talk to anybody that was around those first couple of years, right? Nobody didn't like it. Like everybody said, you know Andrew Lawson, right?
Yeah.
He's one of my best friends, but he is, if I'm the positive, enthusiastic, bring everybody, invite everybody to the party guy, he's the yin to my yang. Right? He's the opposite of that, right? And he's one of the most cynical, jaded people alive. One of my best friends, but we're different in a lot of ways, right? And one day in 2018, I was driving him from Long Branch to a show he was doing in Asbury. I was going to hang out. And he said something that stuck with me for the last 2 years. He goes, I'm so happy those years happened in my 30s, because if they would have happened in my 20s, I would have been too young and naive to appreciate it.
Oh, wow.
And like that just hit me in the chest, because I'm like, me and him, and I think Taylor Allen, maybe Rob, we were all old enough to be like, this is like a second childhood. This is amazing. And I think you younger guys, just by nature being younger, no fault of your own, thought that was just the way the world was. And I think because we had been through our 20s, and it was just like we were, it was a weird thing. We were living through something, and we were appreciating it while we were living through it. And I don't think that happens a
whole lot. No, I think like, to me, what is always so great about it, to me, is like, I sort of look at like a lot of famous comedians who the age that they started at, and a lot of them started around the like same age that I did, like 22, like just like right when you turn 22. And it's just like, I've talked to so many people recently just on the podcast, like about how they feel about when they started and everything. I didn't know that you started doing mics in 2007. What was that whole scene like before, like when you were going and doing that? Like
it was weirdly the Village in New York then, which is the main place that I was doing it, was similar to, not similar, but almost like Asbury Park was in like 2013, but just, it was just more venues and more people were involved in it. But it was the same, and it was a little different too, because it was the very early era of social media,
right?
So it was a little bit harder to find out about stuff. It was like, it was really like a secret society, you know what I mean? And like we're talking, like you couldn't promote a show on Facebook. You had to go stand out in the street and give out flyers to get stage time. And it was just it was a different era because the technology was different. And it was cool, man. If I could have, it's a weird thing. Like at the time, I was kind of upset I couldn't stay in that world.
Right.
But then 5 years later, it took a 5-year hiatus, kind of against my will. But I think it all worked out, because I do kind of think I found my real home, if you will, down the shore. You know,
I mean, like you're such a quintessential part of this. It's so cool to me. And the thing that I love about it is just like, we had, you know, you really said that, like, and it kind of, I know you're a big fan of The Office. It's like that line, you know, I wish we knew when we were in the good years, like we knew when. It's like,
you know, dude, you know, have that.
Like, to me, I just thought it was so, the cool thing was like being around this group of people that were just so like other world to me. I was just like, you know, because growing up, I was held back in kindergarten a year, so I was always older than everyone, and like it was just very like weird growing up. So to come into this like era where like I was the youngest person in the room was really interesting, because I was around all these people that had these just like different personalities. Like,
well, that, we have Jack.
Like, Jack is like a little bit different now. Like, people don't realize. Like, I knew Jack when he was really like 4 years ago, like 5 years
ago.
Yeah.
Well, now he does his character on stage called Relapse Jack. It's legitimately right. One of the funniest things
it's the funniest.
Going
it's
on right now. It's amazing, right? And there's two kinds of people that laugh. When he does that on stage, everybody laughs. Agreed?
Right, yeah.
But there's two kinds of laughs. There's the people that don't know the old Jack and just think it's a funny character, right? Yeah. And then there's the people like me and you that were there for the original Relapse Jack. Yeah. And we're like, this. It's a different kind of laugh because you're like, oh, I saw that for real. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing I love about comedy, and you said you're the youngest guy in the room, is, like, there's nights at Brighton Bar or nights at Crust and Crumble where, like, there's a doctor, a kid that dropped out of high school, a mom, and like, a 18-year-old high school kid all sitting at a table all trying to be funny.
Yeah.
And there's no other scenario in life where those people are all in the same room.
Oh, yeah.
And being friends. Like, if you think about me and you, our age difference and our different, like, life points in life.
Oh, yeah.
There's no scenario we're friends except for stand-up.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And I think that's one of the coolest things about it, that you could be 22 and your best comedy friend might be 50.
Right.
It doesn't happen in too many other aspects of life, man. The people I've met, and again, listen, me and Andrew Lawson have nothing in common, and he's one of my best friends. Right. And that doesn't happen without stand-up comedy.
Yeah, Andrew's great. I used to talk to him a lot. I haven't talked to him in a while since the COVID stuff started. But I saw him at your mic on
yesterday. The super open mic 64.
Yeah. And that was really cool to see him. I didn't get to see him perform.
And I want to shout Gary McLean out for two reasons real quick. He said, number one, he wants to have the longest episode of your podcast, which I think he is. It's already pretty late tonight that we're recording this.
Yeah.
But and then shout out to him because he said I had the best sneakers of anybody in the comedy game. I appreciate that. But the first or second week of the coronavirus, when Carl was pumping out all the content that he had edited from his roast last summer, right?
Yeah.
And then, so Gary posted his video that Kelsey and the Carney Commission made it for him.
Yeah.
He said something that hit me hard, man. He's like, everybody's telling me during the coronavirus, I should be spending this time with my family, but these people are my family.
For
the Brighton Bar crew. And it was like, I don't know, it was weird, man. I felt so happy to be a part of that and be like, dude, I get it, man. Like, it's this group of like wild misfits, but every Monday night, it's a blast.
Whenever I talk about it to like other comedians and other people from like different places, I always say like the New Jersey comedy scene is so like our area, like people don't really, there's so many different sects of the like New Jersey comedy scene. Like I think most people are just more familiar with the New York to like Jersey City type of like crew. But, like, I feel like we're sort of, like, this hidden gem of, like, no, if you come to the Jersey Shore, there's some fire comedians around and just, like...
I think it's different, man. I think it's, like, a subgenre. I've been asked about this before, and I think you do a very funny joke about boomer comics. I love it. It's the best. From the Olive Garden leftovers in the DeLorean.
Yeah.
Where we're going, we don't need punchlines. To the doing drugs with Artie Lang finish. Every part of, if you've ever been to a comedy club in New Jersey, every single part of that's funny, right?
Yeah. I felt, you know, I had a mix of feeling on that because I love that bit, but it's only about like a specific, it's about such a specific group of people and like, it just like, it doesn't include certain people. I wish that I could be like, do like an addendum, like these three people don't fit in this. In
right.
This joke.
Yeah.
Like I want to be like, Donna doesn't fit in this joke.
Yeah,
Max doesn't fit in this joke.
Agreed.
But like,
For the most part, for a sweeping generalization, you nail that, right?
Yeah.
But I think
from a place of like anger and like also like, I just wanted to get like, I also it's kind of just like a nerdy thing. Like I was just finished watching I didn't get to watch the third one yet, but I watched the Back to the Future movies.
Okay.
And I wanted to do like a reference to that, so I had to tie that in.
The way I look at it is, if you know, Asbury Park is a town that's so known for and built on music and music venues, right?
Yeah.
I think the comedians you're referencing in that joke are the people that if we were singers, they're still trying to get a record deal. They're still trying to get a video on MTV, right?
Right.
And they don't understand yet that the game isn't record labels and MTV. It's SoundCloud and and underground venues and building a fan base without a corporation behind you. And I think, like, I think there's still, but even if you look at the people that get Netflix specials, they're not always the people that got past that Scotty's Comedy Cove.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? If you could build a huge social media following and have fans, you can headline and do as many shows you want without ever having the quote-unquote industry give you the thumbs up. And I think we're down here because our, if you look at the background of people in Brighton, it's a lot of people, like, it's skaters, it's kids that were in punk bands or metal bands before they tried comedy. It's kids that used to rap before they did comedy or DJ. And that world is like, we came up in a different world than those comics you're referencing. You know what I mean?
With those comics too, like, and I think it's sort of, it still lingers like that style. Like, I would say New Jersey comedy is like the same way that I would like assume, like, growing up in any part of New Jersey is, and you know, this is common in just comedy in general. People know this nowadays, but like the ball busting, but the level of ball busting, like, matches, like, if you do comedy in Philadelphia or you do comedy in Boston, like, there's just sort of a dark, like, grittiness to it.
And I'm going to say this about real quick. Don't you think to some extent, I'm not a big, like, comedy's important, comedy can change the world. I'm not that guy, right? But don't you think where the world is now and with cancel culture and the way in outside of the comedy world, no one, everybody takes everything you say so seriously. And then we do a roast, your roast or Carl's roast or anybody's roast, and we just go at it for hours and then just tearing each other apart. And at the end of it, everybody at Carl Callen's roast, my face hurt the next day because I laughed so hard. Right. And that, I think, like, the world can learn from that. Like, I don't think we need to have a lawsuit and a press conference every time somebody says something they thought was funny that offended. Like, maybe we don't need to get offended that much.
To me, like, what I always think about with that is, like, the way I heard it perfectly was, you know the comedian Mike Birbiglia?
Yes.
He has a podcast now called Making It or Working On It, and he talks to comedians about, like, what they're working on, their bits and stuff. And he said, like, this perfect thing was that comedy for the longest time used to be very indie. And I remember that when I got into comedy, becoming a huge comedy fan in 2010, that was, like, boom period. Like, comedy at its indie finest. There was Mark Maron on podcasts. Podcasts were just coming out. And it's just like, people, if you were a nerd for stand-up, you had so much avenue to it. Now it feels like, and it has happened before, but it feels like in the 90s and stuff, it feels like comedy has come back into the mainstream. And now the mainstream doesn't know how to handle it.
Yeah, that's true, man.
To me, I'm like, you know, it's like, I get so angry when I read, like, people who review comedy because I'm like, these people, they're not familiar with stand-up. They can't review it in the – they shouldn't review it in the same way that they review a TV show on Netflix. Stand-up is a completely different art form, and it just – it gets so hard because there's such a – there's such an artistry to stand-up, but there's also such a simplicity to it, too, that's like – you know, it's hard to, like, explain, like, the nuance.
Yeah, it's I never heard it put that way before, but it really is, man. It's, at the end of the day, you can argue it's the simplest form of entertainment, right? It's really, if you take the microphone out of it, that's all it does is amplify your voice. It's just you.
Yeah.
It's just you and your words and your stories, right? And it's so simple, but to be good at it, now forget being great. Being great is almost impossible.
Yeah.
But just to be good at it is so hard. Like, it's so much.
Yeah.
It's just, there's so many reasons why not impossible, because a lot of people can do it, but it's just so much. It's so much harder. Because you're, at the end of the day, it's like it's you alone. You can't, like, if you're a rapper and your show bombs, you can put a hot beat on and people respond, right? If you're an actor, there's hundreds of people involved, thousands making a movie. Whereas even the best stand-up comics, they might have a stylist or a writer or a lighting guy, or whatever, but it's really it falls on their shoulders to make it work or not work,
right?
Which is really, really unique. And then I think the other thing is so crazy is, you're chasing the what makes people laugh, and that changes constantly, right? Like, that's funny today might not be funny at all tomorrow. And that's one thing I always wonder about, like, the staying power of stuff, because if you look at, like, a classic stand-up set, like, say Delirious by Eddie Murphy from the 80s, right?
Yeah.
That was the funniest thing people in the 80s had ever seen in their life, right? But if you show that to an 18-year-old kid today, they might look at it and be like, I don't get any of this. Which I don't know if that happens.
It's so funny that you bring that up. it's so interesting that you bring that up, because like the way that I look at that special now is so different, because I have such a, like, it's a, what's the word? It's like knowing the future of what happens is just interesting. Like, people get on that special a lot for him being, you know, homophobic or whatever. And like, it is, and it's jarring to listen to nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a 22-year-old kid who'd been doing stand-up since he was 14 years old. He was red hot. He didn't have the knowledge that they have now about gay people. He was just, take a 14-year-old kid who's doing comedy at this high level, superstar level. Anything that he's going to talk about is not going to have the nuance of a 25-year-old or 30-year-old.
Right.
He's a 16-year-old kid. He's a kid, like, you know, and to me, like, I've read stuff, and he's very apologetic. Like, he's, you know, he's offered so much, like, contributions and, like, paying to, like, gay rights groups and stuff since he was, like, 20 and 30. He's like, you know, he feels so bad about it.
Yeah.
But it's like, you never know what you're going to be. Like, what? That's the thing that's hard, is you never know what's going to be in generations and generations of what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, man, I saw a meme today, actually. So, I mean, it might be a popular meme. I have no idea. But
right.
I thought it's one of those that, like, it's so simple, but it's so true. And it said, if you're the same person at 40 that you were at 20, you just wasted 20 years, which is a great way to look at it. And the other thing I've been struggling with recently, particularly in, the, like, the coronavirus era, we think we have everything figured out, right? We think, look at Eddie Murphy, and, like, that's a barbaric way to look at homosexuality. That's not the way we treat women anymore, X, Y, Z, whatever, right? But, like, in 20 years, our kids and grandkids are going to look at us the exact same way, right? They're going to be
sure.
I think I always think about that the medical profession. It's like we look at what medicine was 100 years ago and think they were wild savages, right? But in 100 years, they're looking at everything we do in a hospital now, and probably including our response to the coronavirus, and thinking they were so stupid in 2020. Because just it's a weird thing, because people want to believe, like, now we have everything figured out, but I don't. Our future generations will not believe that. It's just, history doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I think the biggest part is just, like, having to acknowledge that you live in the society that you live in. Like, I think that's the biggest part for me. It's like when I watch a Dave Chappelle special and I don't agree with something, but I hear people laughing, I say, this is where we are. You know, it's like, yes, we're ahead, but, you know, it's like being like, oh, we live in 2020 and I'm trying to act like we live in 2050.
Right. Or what you think will be
it's
right,
like,
in 2050.
That's my sort of, like, mindset. It's like, I have to stop thinking that we're living in 2050. We're living in 2020 when things are still complicated.
Yeah, I think I have a weird view on this, but I think things have always been complicated. Maybe now with social media, we talk about it a little more, and people have voices. People that would have never had a voice or a mic get a voice and a mic now, which I think is a good thing. I think that's great that we have to confront these things. But I don't see them getting less complicated, right? I don't see
Right.
I'm a weird age, right? I'm my early 40s. So what I've seen and you haven't seen this yet, but you will, a lot of your friends that were very progressive, very inclusive, very don't build a wall, very I see both sides of the Black Lives Matter situation. When they get to be 35, 40, 45 years old, a lot of them change and start acting exactly like their parents.
Oh,
did.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, like, I milked that for laughs a little bit on stage of being like, you want to vote for Trump because of Law and Order, but I know you robbed a Wawa when we were in high school. Like, I know that happened.
It's
like these people that were just like lunatics of breaking laws and partying and doing drugs are now very conservative. And it's almost like what happened? Like, how do you not at least see both sides of the story and not want to jump on one side of it so hardcore? And that's, it's a tough thing to see as I've gotten older. Cause I think, for someone my age, I don't think I act younger. Like, I have a job, I take care of my family, but I have a pretty young person's point of view on things. And I don't really have a desire, if that's what growing up is, I don't really have a desire to grow up and see the world that way.
That's the one thing that I really like about you that I don't think gets mentioned enough is, like, you don't try too hard to be, like the great thing about your hosting and stuff is, like, you never try to come off as, like, you know, talking, like, down to people, or, like, even, like, you know, trying to sound younger. Like, you just sound like you know, this is your experience. Yes. And you want to share this experience with everyone.
I really appreciate that, man. You know what I think I figured out kind of recently about myself that people my age don't have anymore? Like, I really like to experience new things, right? Like, there's people my age that haven't listened to new music in 15 years or haven't seen a new comedian in 15 years. And my thing is, like, when somebody new shows up at Brighton and they're great, I love it. Or when I hear a new song that it's like a 15-year-old rapper made, I'm into it. Like, I don't understand how if you love – like, let's say in your case, like, you heard Blink-182 the first time when you were a kid, and you were like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Don't you want to go listen to the next Blink-182? Like, you can't – you can only listen to those couple albums so many times.
It's so funny. They have there's this band, Sunrise Skater Kids, and they came out with this song that's a parody of every generation of pop punk.
Okay.
And it's to the tune of 1985.
Nice. Okay.
And it basically goes through all the eras of, like, you know, and what they do with everything is it goes through each song, like each like a tune changes to a different song. So it'll be like, you know, it'll be like it'll play like the one part of the song is what's that band? I can't remember it. But they just have, like, it's so great. They just go through all different eras, and in one part there's like the Green Day guys are like complaining about like millennials and stuff, and then you have like a pop punk band that's in their 30s and they're like, I'm reaching 40 myself.
Right.
Like, and it's so, like, great to just acknowledge that. And, like, it's just, it's true. Like, I think everything sort of, we have to get used to everything. And like,
being mad at progress, you know, of anything, just being mad at time marching forward is a loser's game to me. Like, I don't know. Like, I love George Carlin. He's probably my favorite comedian of all time, maybe, but whoever. Or like Chris Rock, I was like, I idolized in the 90s.
For sure.
But to not, like, go look for the next thing, like, how many times can you watch Bring the Pain? It's amazing. Right. It was great to me when it came out. I love it now. But, like, I want to see the next guy that's going to do that, or be around the next guy that's going to do that versus watch the same thing over and over again.
Right. The one thing that I wanted to mention about the Brighton Bar that I think is great, and I think Mike has really mentioned that this is good too, that we do, is I love how, like, there is a, we have sort of a code in, like, a moral code in our circle. Like, it would be so funny, like, you know, we'll see someone go on stage and murder talking about school shootings and do the, like, most offensive school shooting joke ever. And they'll get up stage and they'll get laughs and everything, and everyone will love them. As soon as we have a person that gets on stage, like a new person, like, that gets up and does, like, a hacky racist joke or just a hacky hateful bit, we completely ostracize that person and don't like them at all. We're like, you know, and they can't even complain. They can't be like, oh, you guys are too soft. It's like, no, we just laughed at 15 abortion jokes and you did a gay joke that's and not, like, funny. And it's just, like, it's so interesting that and nice that we have that sort of.
Yeah, like, I liked
I wouldn't want to say hierarchy, but we sort of, like, know, like, the boundaries. Or, of, like, we have our boundaries, and our boundaries aren't constrictive to what you are as an artist. It's more of what you are as a person and who you and how you are, like, getting along with people.
Yeah, man.
Like, I've seen so many people just, like, they get on stage and they don't do good. And instead of being, like, going out and, like, meeting us and talking to everybody and, like, sort of meeting everyone, they sort of just hang back and they don't really, like, you know, interact with us. And it's like, how can you expect to get any better at this if you're not talking to the people that you're performing?
Yeah, man, I totally agree with that. What I found in my – and this is something you find as you get older. When I do – anytime I've done well at pretty much anything in life, whether it's sports, comedy, I was always comfortable with the people and the places I practiced that thing, right? So what I want to create from back in the day at Bank on Madison to what I've done at Brighton Bar the last couple years, I want to create that experience where if you were a regular, you could go on stage and try that joke that that might be, you know, a gray area. You might not know if it works or not.
Right.
You feel comfortable. Like, all right, if it fails, it fails. If it wins, I'm going to use it forever. But I don't think you can – not ever. I can't get better if I'm not comfortable in a situation. You know what I mean? And that's right. Why, like, if you come all the time and you become a regular and you play by the rules that you kind of just outlined, the way I think you said it pretty well, you can be get comfortable right. And try new stuff all the time and not get ostracized for doing one bad joke or one that doesn't land. The right. Only thing I can't stand – I thought you were going in this direction because – I hate when people make fun of a venue or a host or a bartender at a place that's letting them perform. I have no tolerance for that, man. Like, if you're going to come into any place I'm a host and make fun of the venue or the bar, these people have a business. They're handing the keys over to you for the night and you come there and you're not buying drinks or tipping the bartenders or waiters, waitresses. Like, I have just no tolerance for that because they don't have to have that open mic. They could book a band. They could book trivia. They could put TVs. They could put Monday Night Football on. There's a million other things they could do to make money that night, and they're giving you a mic. You got to at least be appreciative of that. And that's – I really don't like that at all, man. I've never – it's always like new people that don't get it yet. And I'm like, why would you leave your house to make fun of a venue or a scene or a group of people? You could have just stayed home. Like, you could have just – watch TV in your house and not done this. And I think that's one thing where comedies don't – I don't think – one thing I think I've done pretty good at over the years is, like, understanding the economic side of what we do. Because I think, like, most – it's art and commerce, right? And if you can't – and unfortunately, if you can't create the commerce, a lot of times you can't create the art, right? So, like, I think one thing our regulars do at Brighton Bar, which is great, is they buy drinks. They buy food. When the world shut down and you couldn't go in a bar anymore, as a group, we were buying food there for takeout every weekend, right? Because Greg was putting it up on – Greg's the owner – putting up on Facebook who was there. And it was me. It was Carl. It was you. It was Joe Borzotti. Yeah. It was, you know, the people that come all the time. And I think, like, that kind of shows what a strong community is. Like, we went out of our way to spend money there as opposed to going to McDonald's or Burger King or somewhere else that doesn't support us, and we supported them. And now we were the first one back in New Jersey, to my knowledge, or one of the first. And now we're thriving again because they've been so great to work with.
Right. I wanted to mention two things. The Brighton Bar recently won for a second time an award for, like, best comedy club in
Monmouth County.
And, like, that's so interesting to me because technically, like, really, it's not a comedy club, but it has become one. And, like, it's so cool that that has happened because, like, I was watching I don't know if you have Showtime or not, but they have this new documentary about the Comedy Store. And it's amazing. And they have this old comedian from the 80s. He's like interviewing people now. So he's interviewing all these people, Bill Byrne, all these people that have – David Letterman, all these people that started there. And just, like, the way that they talk about it reminds me of the Brighton Bar in certain –
I got to check that out. I know that documentary was coming out. I have not seen any episodes of it yet.
Yeah, it's really good. But it's like, what I thought about it was we sort of have the same thing. Like, what I like about it is it's a good, like, thing. Like, you know, sure, most of the shows that we do and, like, open mics and stuff are, you know, we don't get paid. But if you put a show together, the venue is really good about paying people. And they take, like, half the door and then they give you so much. That's what I realized when I did my roast was, like, I was able to pay so many people.
Yeah, it was great, man. They...
I got so, I was like, oh, darn, when Rob canceled on me because he had to work, I wanted to tell him, like, I didn't know if I was going to be able to pay people. But, like, if I knew that I'd get, like, most of the door and be able to pay everyone back, I would have told him, you don't have to –
right, we'll pay you. I'll pay you for the hours of admission or whatever, man. And I think one thing we could – this is myself included – can do better at is, like, your roast, great night. Roast of Carl, great night.
Yeah.
The shows Jacinda has done there for charities have been great, right? I wish people kind of got the ball rolling, not in the coronavirus world, but when we go back to normal, Like, if something happens, we just keep building on the next one. You know what I mean? That's where it really becomes powerful, where it's like, okay, Rich did a show on Monday, and then Jacinda does a show on Wednesday, and then Don Harris is doing a show on Friday, and just keeps – and that's not all Brighton, but just the surrounding area.
Right.
Whereas now I feel like when you look back at, like, the last couple of years, you got – mics that were regular, you got mine, you got Jess's Anchors Bands, you got the mics that happened regularly, and then you got a handful of like really great shows in Roast. Whereas I think in the future we got to kind of take the bull by the horns and be like, okay, they crushed a show in September, I want to do something similar in October and just keep growing.
Right. Yeah, I just think it's like, it's just so cool to just, and like you said, like you guys, with being your age, you've been able to sort of like think of like, be really grateful for everything. And I'm very grateful too, but it's just so cool to be in like the days of like, this is like in the middle of something happening. I would say like, it's sort of easy to say because it's from like a punk art scene, but it does feel very much like a punk scene of like, we're really building something. And it feels like, I feel so like part of me wishes like we had more, like we have gotten, you know, we've gotten the award, and we've gotten, like, some stuff and some appreciation. But I really wish that we had more of a spotlight. That's just, like, for me, it's, like, I wish that, like, I remember, I don't remember that kid's name. Was it Andy? The kid that was, the guy that was the most on...
Andy Mizrahi.
Yeah, him. Like, I remember when he was starting out, he was, like, he was filming us for something, like, some type of thing in college and, like, that he was doing. And he never ended up making it. And I was like, I wish, like, that was early. And I was like, I wish that we had someone like that now that was sort of recording it in a documentary sense. Because I feel like there's such a, like, story that you can tell through all of us that just are, that feels like a real generational, like, real
I agree with that, man. I was working with him on that a little bit. I thought it would have been great, right? And it's unfortunate he ended up doing a lot of stuff because that Twitter award, not Twitter, Tinder award ended up, he moved to LA for a while, and now I think he's in the city. But either way, you know what I think is cool that happened this year is all the podcasts dedicated to it, right? So there's you, there's Foul House, Kyle Groom is doing. The scene is being documented. Yeah. Not, I'd like to see it be more visually documented, like you said.
Yeah.
But the idea that, like, if this is the next big thing, there's hours and hours of audio of people talking about it, which wouldn't have existed if you were doing this in the 90s. It just wouldn't have been possible.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes me really excited about doing this podcast is, like, I'm so happy now that I've, like, because really when I was doing it without a microphone or anything, I was being very lazy when I could have done it better. And now that I'm doing it better and I have better audio and stuff, and I'm like, now I'm just so excited. Like, you should see, like, the list that I have of people that I want to have on, like, because I have, like, two people that are, some people that are, like, semi, like, notable. Like, I want to get
Gordon on. Nice, he's great. Absolutely.
You know, Gordon Baker Bone. I want to get him on. I started when he was, you know, still doing open mics and stuff. Did you ever meet Steve Wegg?
No.
He has a show with, what's his name? Rami something.
Are they in New Jersey or in the city?
And, they're from.
No, I don't know. I don't know them.
And they have a show on Hulu now, that's based on because they met each other and when they were young. And Rami is Middle Eastern, and Steve Way, he has muscular dystrophy, and they got a Hulu show recently, like last year, just about both of them. And, like, it's so cool to, like, see them, like, get some notoriety. And it's, like, so weird because I did mics with them, like, when they were, you know, starting out. Like, Steve put me on a bunch of, like, he hosted these stuff in, somewhere in New Jersey. And he had, like, his own theater that he would perform at. And it was just, it was fucking great. And I was just like, it's so cool to see like people that I know kind of get like a
I love that, man. I think that's one thing. Like, there's two ways you could take that. One, you could get mad and be like, why did he or she get that and not me, and be a hater. Or you can look at it as you're close to doing that. You know what I mean? I think sometimes everybody does. Like, I'm such a fan of what we do and the people we do it with. 90% of the time, I'm rooting for people to succeed, right? And then temper. I only know him on Facebook. Yeah. And we Facebook message. I've never met him in person. I think he's a pretty good. From what I can see, he does a good job of being busy and creating opportunities and putting shows on for people. Am I correct when I say that?
Yeah, I met him right before he left New York, and then I just met him 2 years. Well, I saw him and I met him a couple years ago, and it's just he's doing stuff, and it's just so cool. I get so jealous sometimes. I'm like, oh my god, he's doing all these shows, but then I still have to remember he's. As much as he's doing stuff with shows with Mark Norman and stuff like that, he still does
it. Dude, I'll tell you, what hurts as a comic when you Instagram, because Instagram, you see people's apartments, you see people's cars, and back in the day, if you were a touring comic and you're headlining clubs across the country, I would have assumed you were wealthy. You know what I mean? And then you see what that life is like on Instagram, and their YouTube channel and stuff. And you're it's a weird thing that you could fill up a venue every night across the country and not have a great house or not. Your apartment isn't even as good as somebody with just a regular day job. And then you start to go down the rabbit hole of why am I even doing this? Are you there?
Yeah.
You know, but
it's so interesting when I talk to people who are older, who aren't in comedy. And I'm like, there used to be, there used to be people would go on Johnny Carson and then that would be it. I know people I just know certain comics that I've seen do late night sets and then on Jimmy Fallon or whatever, and throw out some mics the next week. And it's you never when that used to happen to people, they used to, they used to blow up, and now people, it's so much. And that's with the internet stuff too.
Two things real quick. I've come to the conclusion the last couple of years of the chances of actually making a living at this are so slim. If you don't love it, you should take your time and do something else, right? But if you love it, I have a day job. I don't see that stopping anytime soon for comedy. Just the way my life is, that's what my life is going to be. But I love being a part of it, and I love being on stage. And if this is my hobby for the rest of my life, I'm going to have a hobby I love, which is cool. You know what I mean?
That's what's great for you is you have – you have this thing that you can craft so well and keep. I think you have I don't want to assume anything. You could probably go on and do greater and better things, but if you just keep with, I just think you've done such a great job at creating this community and keeping it going. And that's the biggest thing that we can ask for, is just to have a reoccurring thing that always, I think that's the thing that we're always looking for in comedy, is just, comedians are nomadic. We go wherever, but to have a certain place that's safe is not, it's not common.
No. Absolutely. And then what happened to me, man, here's a great little story about that is in 2015, in May of 2015, I was running the showroom Comedy on Cooking show once a month. It was in a theater with 66 seats. A lot of them were sold out. They were all well attended, right? And I was running the open mic at Bank on Madison, which was every other week in about 20. It was basically the Brighton Bar feel and vibe. Brighton Bar is a little better, but similar vibe in Asbury every other week for about a year. In 1 week, the Bank on Madison shut down with absolutely no notice. They just shut the doors. They were not going to be in business anymore. So that ended. Right. And then Comedy on Cookman, after a couple of shows didn't sell a lot of tickets, they just decided to end it point blank with no notice, right? And I went from having two of the biggest shows in New Jersey to having nothing, right, in the span of 1 week. And none of that was due to me. I didn't do anything wrong. It's just what happened. Then the next month, my daughter was born. I spent a couple months just being a dad. And then the next couple of years, like that next era kind of started where like Jess came around and she started Anchor's Bend and started getting concubines booked on Asbury Underground, which is awesome. Rob and Dan took Crust and Crumble and really ran with it, right? And then like Warm Things, like Dan Gagliardi and Melissa Jabin, they were doing their shows with comedians on them. And it was I fell back a little bit because kind of they kind of took the ball and ran with it. And then when my daughter got a little older and Heather was ready to give up Brighton Bar because she had to take care of the personal stuff with her family, I was just in the right place. It was perfect. I live a mile away from the place. It's every Monday. And now I'm kind of a little more of a prominent part of it. But I'm like, I feel like a lot of times people have something going, it's good, it goes left, and they give up. And if you just stay in the game long enough, stuff will probably start to break in your favor if you hang in there long enough.
I definitely we've been having a great time for like 48 minutes now. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions I didn't get to ask. I always ask like stereotypical questions, but like growing up, were you like was your family really into comedy?
I was told to stop being a clown by my parents so many times growing up. And here's what happened. In the 80s, comedy was very – it was like kids didn't like comedy. Your parents did. You know what I mean? So it was like – and then some of that was great.
Right.
Like Rodney Dangerfield, Jerry Seinfeld, Tim Allen, Eddie Murphy, obviously that crew. But it wasn't geared towards like teenagers at all, right? And then so I was vaguely aware of it. I remember watching Johnny Carson when I was a very little kid. But then in the early 90s, when basic cable happened, it was like all of a sudden – at one time in my life, I was introduced to The State, the MTV sketch comedy show. Everybody on that show has blown up since then.
Right.
You know, 911, a bunch of movies. Def Comedy Jam came on, which was to a suburban kid in, Toms River, New Jersey. That was something so foreign to me. I couldn't believe it was a real thing, right? Martin came on TV, the Martin Lawrence TV show. And the thing that hit me in the chest was the Jerky Boys, these prank call tapes that were just so profane.
Right.
So I laugh out loud and listen to them today. And then all of a sudden, like, I was like, oh, there's all these other things that are comedy. It's not just a guy with a sport coat talking about how much he hates his mother-in-law. And I'm like, oh, this is me. I'm into this.
Right.
But then even through high school,
my
friends were not those kind of kids. Like I would go listen. I would watch Saturday Night Live and have nobody to talk to about it with. And then towards the end of high school, I met another group of friends, and they were like me, like they were like dissecting episodes of Seinfeld and listening to trading comedy tapes and Adam Sandler CDs and stuff. And I was like, oh, there's other people like me, but I was still like super quiet, super shy. And then it took like another 10 years to kind of try and open mic. And well, I did it though. I went to the city. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. And I just went there. And I did it for like 3 or 4 months of nobody in my real life knowing I was doing this. And then when I got down to Asbury and had to start selling tickets, I had to like open it up to my friends and family and be like, yeah, I'm doing this thing. If you guys could come really help me out. And then it became this really like fun thing where my friends and family would come down to the monthly Comedy Cookman shows and just go out and have a couple of drinks afterwards. It was really fun. But that's kind of my version of where I was like, I was too quiet to really try to be funny. But
when that whole thing happened with you like starting to book shows and doing that and putting on shows, that's sort of cool. That like, did your parents like ever like, did they change their mind a little bit in what they sort of assumed?
Yeah, man.
Early and, on, like as a kid, like, telling you not to joke around now.
Yeah,
they do, man.
And it's a weird thing. My mom passed away before any of this kind of started for me, but my dad and my stepmom. People, I think a lot of comics have a lot of beef with their families, right? And I weirdly don't, man. Like, my family's been incredibly supportive. If I do a show, my dad and stepmom might be there. A bunch of my cousins might be there. I'm doing a podcast with two of my cousins now called Me and My Cousins. So it's a weird thing.
Right.
I have a family where nobody is – they're not – I don't want to say not artistic, but they're not – I'm the only person to kind of do this stuff. And they most of them, at least on my face, think it's cool and are supportive, which is cool, man. And then, and I think my dad, every once in a while, will see my name on a poster. I'll be in Asbury Park Press, and he'll call me to tell me he thinks it's great, which is cool. Like, what else can you ask for?
Yeah. I think that's the same thing with my family. What was so, like, great to them was I was never a shy kid. Like, I was not, like, afraid to talk to people. I was just very, like, my teacher one time. used this word for me. Like, I still don't, like, think it's right. She said, like, modest. Mm-hmm. She said, like, humble. And I think she meant, like, modest. And it's like, I never wanted to draw attention to myself because I always felt like drawing attention to yourself is negative attention. And, like, to me, it was like, I just tried. And then what happened with me is, I think when you grow up anywhere in New Jersey, there's a lot of, you just grow up in a different type of era of just teasing and just ball busting. And just like, I was so sensitive back then. So I really started like getting an edge when I was 15, like 14, 15, 16 of when I would get picked on in school, I would talk back like really snarky. And I would make these like jokes and I would insult like people back. And I wouldn't get in trouble. The teachers would laugh. Like if I like if someone was picking on me, I said something that would usually get another student in trouble. They would not be mad at me because they'd be like, "Oh, that's hilarious."
I was in a similar boat of being pretty sensitive and offended by things. And then what I kind of discovered is, and I wish I discovered earlier, is like a lot of times if you're the one getting picked on or getting ribbed by people, that means you're part of the crew. You know, that means you're part of the gang now. And if you can get it back, even better, you know?
Right. Like, you never know that because, like, it's such a weird thing to be, like, that can come from confrontation. And, like, you know, a lot of it is, you know, and when you're growing up and, like, little kids and this stuff, like, little kids are not malicious. They just want to have fun.
Yeah, and so they tell the truth in the wrong way. Little kids tell the truth in a way adults just don't. Yeah. Like you develop a filter over time, and they'll say something to you, and it'll just hit you in the chest, and you're like, "Oh, I didn't." But the 5-year-old probably didn't mean it that way, right?
Right. Yeah. Like they don't have any type of like.
The other thing, man. Last night I was on the Simmons and Moore podcast. So shout out to those guys, and I've been on their show a bunch of times, and they brought something up to me, which really not. It comes up once in a while, but they're like, your voice and your mannerisms are so aggressive, but you're like a nice guy, like you're not that guy. And I'm like, I think in New Jersey, let's say for example, a 1 is like completely at peace with yourself in the world, and a 10 is blind rage and fury.
Right.
We all operate at about a 6 or a 7. Just off top, you know what I mean? And it's like, I think there's good and bad. Like on stage, I think it's awesome to see somebody that likes that, right? I think musicians are great when they operate in that space. Then the problem is we operate in that space where we're driving on the parkway, when we're in line at Best Buy, and we start fighting with each other and, you know, acting. And that's not good. But I mean, I think like we have just a natural edge and aggression to us that other places don't have. And then when you combine that natural swagger, edge, and aggression with someone that can actually write jokes and write material, you get the people that we've been talking about that crush at these, you know, the Brighton Bar and similar venues.
Right. Yeah. It's I wanted to ask you because you're a big like rap
100%
fan, like rap head, right? Did you ever have any type of like, I know you said that you didn't really perform and stuff when you were younger, but did you have any? Did you ever have any type of aspirations of like coming?
No,
of
becoming, man.
You know, rapper or doing anything
I DJ'd for a little while. But the rap thing was weird because I was in high school and college pretty much between Vanilla Ice and Eminem. So I grew up in an era where there were no white rappers doing anything, right? And then the other, I grew up in an era where there wasn't SoundCloud, there wasn't Serato, there wasn't, you know, GarageBand on every Mac. So it was like, it was so hard to even think about being a rapper. It really never crossed my mind. Not to say I would have been good at it. I probably wouldn't have. But I mean, there's a couple of nights at the end of the party, I'd freestyle or whatever and try to be funny while I was doing it. But if I was a kid now, I think I would probably be like every other kid with a SoundCloud page, and I'd be, you know, Little Angelo 357 on SoundCloud. But it's so easy to try it now. But the era I grew up in was so hard, and there were so many barriers to entry. It wasn't something I thought about doing. But I have remained an absurd hip-hop fan for someone that's in their 40s now. And that's another thing, man. People like want to scream, "Oh, these young rappers are terrible. They're all trash." And I'm like, all right, but you're not trying. You're not listening to what's going on now. So if you don't, it's like saying everybody at the Jersey Shore is a trash comedian and you've never been to a show at the Jersey Shore. You can't say that till you go experience it. and I always get mad at people my age are like, oh, this era of music is terrible. It's like, no, the music's not terrible. You're terrible because you're not making an effort to listen to it.
Yeah. It's like, you also got to realize, like, what they're, like, even though I might not like it, I just got to realize, like, these are what, like, the one thing that I really, like, don't like is a lot of the, and you probably, I don't know if you know them, is I haven't kept up with them over the years, but I just remember a few years ago of, like, these YouTube kids that were just terrible.
Yep.
Like, you probably know him, like, Ricegum. I was just like, I fucking felt so bad for people who were rap fans, like, bigger than me. Because I was like, this is the shit that you have to deal with and explain to people who aren't fans of your music.
Yeah, it's like, you constantly answer to them.
And it's like, it's sort of the same way of, like, when we have to explain, like, boomer comics to people. Is like, we have to be like, no, this is, like, this is an old-time thing. It's a weird thing. Like,
I think it happens in any subculture that you always end up answering for the worst of that subculture. You know what I mean? And you know what? It happens to us a lot with
comedians
that do things that are – they break the law, they overdose on drugs, they get in trouble with the law, whatever it is. And people are all comedians like that. And I always tell people, comedy probably comes from a dark place, but like most of the people I know are not doing those things. Like I do a comedy show and I go home to my wife and daughter. I don't drive 100 miles an hour over the Brooklyn Bridge. I've never done that. So I think it's like, but you always answer, you end up getting asked about the worst of any subgenre.
Yeah. I think the one thing, and I don't know if this is, like, just true New Jersey, there is a party scene to it, but to me, it's, like, it always feels like people are, you know, I always feel like, it's not the 70s anymore. What are people doing?
Yeah,
I'm like, you don't have
to. No, and the other thing is that I think it's different at the level like, we are versus, like, headliners. We're not making that much money where we can go blow it all at the bar the minute we're done, right? Like if I make $50 to do a show, I want to go keep it and buy my daughter lunch the next day with it. I don't want to give it all right back to the bartender. I don't do drugs, but I wouldn't want to spend it all on drugs and just being out partying like crazy. Now, if I was getting $5,000 a night and I had just money to burn, maybe my view would be different. But that's not where I am right now.
Right. I definitely wish we could go longer, but we've been doing about an hour. I plugged some of your stuff in the beginning of your podcast and stuff. Do you have anything that you want
to for right now, man, like, I got the podcast every week with my two cousins. Shout out to them, Mike Casal and Kenny Nkoji. It's me and my cousins. I'm in my 40s. Mike's in his 30s. Kenny's in his 20s. And we kind of talk about just the world from, you know, three different points of view. We've had a couple comics on. We'll definitely have you on at some point. But right now, there's so many podcasts doing comics. I'm trying to hit different Jersey Shore people, like musicians, business owners, visual artists, stuff like that. But I'll definitely throw some comics in soon. And then every Monday is the Brighton Bar. We talked about that a lot, man. I'm so lucky to be a part of that people like you made it what it is. You know what I mean? Like I'm the host of it. But if you don't come every week and you don't go at it with Dan Caprio every week and you don't come with the fire boomer comic joke every week, like that's not, we don't win that award. It ends, there's nothing to talk about if I'm sitting there by myself, right? I can't do 3 hours by myself. You guys do the time. I just tell people who we are at the end of the day. And then I hopefully every month moving forward, we're out of date for November. We're gonna keep doing Super Open Mic 64, where you guys come and play video games and we're doing a mic after that. What are your thoughts on that, Rich? Do you like that? You think it's going pretty well? Yeah.
That mic, I like it a lot, I feel really, like, I have to, I don't know if I should apologize or not for this. I'm not going to mention his name.
Okay.
Because I may or may not have him on the podcast. But there's a comedian that we both know, and he's newish. He might be 2, maybe 3 years in now. I don't know. I think it's 2 years. But he's just, like, he's not, like, good. And to me, like, it would be fine if he was like, if he was aware of not being not good, but I don't think he knows. So there are just some cringy things where it's like, I don't ever want to, I just realized like certain things, like I never wanted to be that person that goes out and misses, like goes outside and meets with the comics to miss another person's set. Like that just feels like a shitty thing to do.
Right.
And I just feel myself doing that with this guy.
I can't do it.
Watch this. Like the way I described watching his set, and it still feels the way it's like sitting it's like being stabbed in the nuts. Yeah. It just doesn't feel like.
Yeah, I can't
watch it. And I want to be supportive, and I want to be like, you know, I want to give this guy time to get better and stuff. And it's just like, it feels so bad. So like he was, you know, like he was just like he went on stage for no material. Well, stage, like there's not a stage at the mic at the arcade, but like he instantly went up this other comic bit, like because he didn't understand the joke. And it's just like, to me, it's like it was just obvious that he didn't write anything. And to me, I immediately left right. Sort of Thanos like out of the room. I was like, I think everyone noticed. I was just like, my dad came to pick me up, like, and he came in a few minutes earlier, and it was like before we started. And then that was all going on. And I was sitting right in the front, like, which was a bad idea. And just when it started going like down, like south, right. Like, I'm out of here. Abort. I gotta leave. And I felt so like, oh, I'm such an asshole. They're gonna be so mad at me that I did that. Like, I just want you to know, like, that I wish that I could have stayed.
Yeah, man, I
secondhand embarrassment.
That's the thing about the level we are in open mics in general. There's like this level of it could be the greatest thing ever, or it could be a complete train wreck, and there's no way you could tell. You know what I mean? There's like, think about the lights at Brighton, where there's like 7 great sets in a row, right? And you're sitting there and you're like, this should be on Netflix. This is the best thing ever.
Right.
And then the next 5 people might be do horrible. Right. It's just such a dice game and a dice roll. And like, I like it. I always say I would rather watch a new comic try new stuff and experiment, and maybe it's great, maybe it's bad, as opposed to watching like a road comic do the same 8-minute set he's been doing for the last 3 years. So I get what you mean. Right. Some people,
I just felt bad about that. I was like, this is not.
No,
I'm
not even sure this what you're talking about. I'll text you later about it. But yeah, man, and there's just some things you don't. I mean, there's comics I don't like. I don't find funny. But this is comedy subjective. So like, what can you do about it? What else you got for me?
Right. I don't mind saying who it is. I won't say his last name. Connor. That whole thing. That's when I left and was like,
gotcha.
Yeah, I can't do this. It was just like, I felt so bad because I don't want to be that person. You know, because like that's sort of like the bad thing about, you know, I think in any, that happens in any like group of people in stand-up, is you just have people that like, they stay for their friends and they don't stay for everybody. And it just becomes a thing where people don't.
Yeah, or
stay
yeah,
when they
the one thing. Yeah, I think people should. If you can't, I don't think you can run out of the room the minute you're done. I think you gotta support this. If you gotta be cognizant enough to support the scene that's supporting you, and try to give back just a little bit. And we're not asking for much. We're asking you to just sit down for a couple minutes and maybe laugh if you hear something you like. That seems like enough. In your case, I think you've done enough to warrant leaving early once in a while, obviously. You know what I mean? But there's other people that maybe have. I don't know if I'm going to call anybody out, but just and then there's people that do it like to an extreme. Like Dan Caprio sits in the same spot at Brighton Bar for 3 hours every Monday, which it's amazing. Like it's an absurd level of support for his friends. Yeah. And in some cases, he sits through people he can't stand, which is I have to do it when I'm hosting, but he's great at it. But I get it, man. No big deal.
Yeah. So thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for giving me a lot of time.
Oh, no, man, dude, this is great, dude. Thank you very much. And thanks for being a part of everything, dude. For the last two, I guess I've known you for 5 years now, which is amazing.
Thank you so much.
But like I said, man, it's awesome. And this podcast is great. I've listened to, I think, every episode. And as far as just giving people a voice and having good questions, I think you're killing it, man. So keep rolling.
Yeah. Next week I have Tim Rager on, so I'm really, really excited for that. I just wanted to get you on because you're the 9th interview that I've done.
Nice, like, man. I appreciate that.
In the top 10. It's like, that's a must need. I needed Dan. I needed, you know, certain people. I was just like, this is a perfect.
Thanks, man. This is
so
great. Have a great night.
This.
And I'm looking forward to hearing this when it drops. Please tag me and everything. I'll promote it as best I can.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, man. Have a great night. Yeah. Thanks again, Rich.
All right, great.
Bye-bye.